Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, August 9th, 2021, and I'm the host of the show, Cara Santa Maria. And before we dive into this week's episode, I do want to thank those of you who help make Talk Nerdy possible week after week after week after week. Remember, Talk Nerdy is and will always be 100% free to download, and that is because of the generous support of listeners just like you. If you want to pledge your support for the show, all you've got to do is visit patreon.com/talknerdy, or you can go to my podcast website at talknerdy.com. This week, I want to thank Mary Neva, Rob Shrek, Pasquale Gelati, Brian Holden, Christopher Pitts, Daniel Lang, David J.E. Smith, Dudas Infinitas, June Sapara, Ulrika Hagman, and Robert Christ for their support of the show. All right, let's get into it. So this week, I have the opportunity to sit down with Dr. Jordan Ellenberg, and he is the author of Shape, The Hidden Geometry of Information, Biology, Strategy, Democracy, and Everything Else. Dr. Ellenberg is the John D. MacArthur Professor of Mathematics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He has won a ton of career awards and grants, and he's been writing kind of public mathematics, you know, communication about mathematics for forward-facing, like non-academic audiences for many, many years. He's written columns or one-offs in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, Slate, the Washington Post, Wired, Boston Globe, all these wonderful outlets. And this is not his first book. He wrote How Not to Be Wrong and, a novel. I didn't know that. Or did I know that? The Grasshopper King. Very cool. But of course, the new book, Shape, is the topic of our conversation today. So we're going to talk geometry, we're going to talk math. Without any further ado, here he is, Dr. Jordan Ellenberg. Well, Jordan, thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, thank you for having me on.
So this is, it's been a bit since we've talked math on Talk Nerdy. I've had now a handful.
How can you even call it Talk Nerdy then?
I know. It's like, it's so heavy, heavy science. But, you know, when it comes to STEM, I try to hit all of my bases. And I've definitely done a handful of like pretty intensive math episodes. But I'm excited to talk nerdy specifically about your new book, Shape. I mean, I think we'll be going, you know, all over the place. But I love that you decided to really focus on geometry for this book and also, you know, make it real. I think that's the most important part is when math feels really esoteric, it feels really far away from people. And to get people, as you know, excited about STEM, it has to relate to us in some form or another.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I live my research life in some of the most like abstract reaches of geometry you can imagine. But as somebody who talks about math to the public and writes about math for the public, I know very well that what people really respond to is seeing the geometric understructure of stuff that they already know they care about.
Right, right. And, you know, I think that geometry specifically is interesting to a lot of people because you're right, there's a really visual and conceptual component to it. Obviously, there are also theoretical components to it. And there are some things that might feel a little bit farther away if you don't, quote unquote, speak the language. But there is something that's much more transferable about geometry? Or do you disagree? Do you think that like all forms of math are graspable so long as they're sort of presented the right way?
I would say it's all graspable. And there's certainly like aspects of our life that I would say are algebraic. There's definitely aspects of our life that I would say are probabilistic. But probably I think it's fair to say that geometry is the most easily graspable. And maybe one of the ways you can see that is that it's, you know, really one of the first branches of math to really be formalized and thought about. I mean, probability, of course, people knew that things happened by chance, but that there was a mathematical theory underlying it doesn't come until much later. Geometry is there almost from the very beginning of people we know writing down things that we would call mathematics today. People were doing geometry.
And, you know, when we think about mathematics, I mean, it's sort of weird because it's a construct that I feel like everybody knows what it is. Like, you almost don't have to define it because they're like, yeah, math, mathematics, whatever, I get it. Numbers and stuff. But then when you actually start talking about what mathematics is, there's some really interesting philosophy, some interesting theory. Like, for example, you're mentioning that geometry was, you know, basically there from the beginning. It was one of the first recorded forms. But there's still that question, which is math the formalization of these rules and laws that exist in nature? Is it our human writing down of these things? Or is math intrinsic to nature? Does it exist in and of itself?
Yeah, and that is a question that people ask all the time. I'm going to be straight with you, Kara. It's not a question that I'm that interested in.
Ah, cool. Okay, I like that. Why is that?
Well, in the, you know, the question of like, would math be there without us? That's one way to put it. Was it there in nature and exists outside and independent if there was no such thing as a human? Well, there is such a thing as a human, and we do math. So the math that we know, the math that I talk about, the math that I think about is a thing that humans do. It's made of people. Whether or not in some kind of alternate universe where humans or any other kind of thinking beings had never existed, there would be such a thing as math. That's a philosophical question of some interest and some import, but it's not so relevant to my life. I want to tell stories about the things that actual human beings actually did to solve their human problems, and those are so, so often mathematical in nature.
So how is it that you kind of make the link or the jump between the more academic mathematics that you do, that you said can be somewhat conceptual, can be somewhat abstract, and the public communication of mathematics, specifically with your newest book, Shape? Like, are there places where your own work is really, really heavily imbued, or do you feel sometimes like you have to be like, okay, I'm putting my work on the shelf when I talk about these things?
Well, you know, like a lot of things, it was kind of an accident. I mean, I wanted to be a writer when I was young. And before I even went to math grad school, I did like a year's master's degree in creative writing, just thinking about how to put sentences together into stories. I found out that, you know, being a writer of literary fiction was not really my bag. I was kind of bummed out every day trying to do that. It's like very hard work. The rewards are very intermittent and sometimes take a long time to come. But I think what I brought with me from that experience is, as a teacher teaching mathematics, you're always a storyteller, right? If you want it to work in the classroom, there's got to be a narrative. There's got to be a plot. There's got to be a story with characters and a beginning and an end. And so I think to some extent, writing about math for the public is an outgrowth of my teaching. I see it as kind of the same process, just done on paper instead of in a room and with hopefully a somewhat bigger audience than the number of kids I can teach in the classroom at one time. And I would actually say, you know, when I started doing it, and I've been, God, for like 20 years now, I guess, like writing about math for the public, it really was a completely separate thing from my research. Now, as I've sort of learned about all these stories and sort of talked about and learned about all these ways that math interacts with the physical and the social world, that's actually crept back more into my research in some sense as a result of that, of like talking to all the really interesting people in so many different applied areas who use these mathematical ideas.
You know, I have to say, I love the basically the understanding, the conceptualization that you have about math needing to feel narrative in order for all people to feel connected, not just the people who have what they might consider a natural inclination, or people who, you know, arrive to class already hungry to learn more about mathematics. This is always a percentage of kids, right, who are just like, I love math. This is cool. I love it. You know, it fascinates me. And then there are other kids who are like, I'm so incredibly afraid that I'm not going to do well at this, that I have this like massive mental block about it. And it's really hard for me to even want to try because it's really scary when I fail. And humanizing it, you know, telling it in a story form. Like, I only wish that I had mathematics teachers and professors who did that for me. I think I had one course, and I was lucky enough in my undergrad in statistics from the math department that was actually so good. And stats is very kind of easily transferred into that narrative form. But that professor was so good that it launched me into being really fundamentally interested.
Names. You can't give praise like that without naming a name.
I know. I have to look back now. I think really a big part of it was the textbook, which, and I remembered, I can see it right now. It's called Statistics by Purvis. And it's like, it was all like poker and casino and like game theory. And it really, really helped me grasp basic statistics so that then later when I did social science statistics, it spoke to me in a fundamental way. But yeah, I don't know if everybody gets that opportunity.
Well, and you know, the tragedy of it is that it's not like you're in your austere math research world and then you come into the classroom and you have to put on your narrator hat. Talking in stories is the way mathematicians talk to each other. I mean, within our world of research, we would always talk about the punchline of a proof, for instance. Okay, so what are you saying by saying that, except to concede that a proof is a story with hopefully a kicky ending that provides the kind of explosive delight that a joke does. So, I mean, that is the way we talk to each other. And then sometimes I think, unfortunately, there is a sort of habit of coming into the classroom and say, now we have to be very austere, for we are mathematicians. Now we're not going to talk about it to our students the way we talk about it internally to each other. Like, no, we should, because we are human beings. And like, it's very natural when we're trying to explain things to each other to explain it in the form of a story.
You're so right. Like sometimes when I teach science communication and I'm talking to professors who don't have a lot of experience, like in front of the media, for example, they're like, how do I get interviewed or what kinds of things should I do? And it's like, you don't have to try and sound so smart. We all know you're really smart. You don't have to prove it to us. You just be you, my friend, and talk to me like a real person. And it's not, I really don't like it when people say, you know, talk. Tell me how you would tell your grandma, you know, or dumb it down for me, because that's not what it's about. It's about
my grandma was sharp as hell. I know it's what are you talking about?
That makes me happy. Yeah, why is there an assumption that grandma wasn't very bright? Whatever, grandma like raised your parents and then you.
I mean, but the other thing you said, I mean, you gave me so much to go on there. I mean, the other thing you said, this fear that students have in the classroom, you're absolutely right. Students have a fear of being wrong, a fear of, I don't think it's too much to call it humiliation, that sense that kids experience. And that is something that as teachers, we can all work to have a classroom where you can be wrong and it's not humiliating. Because real mathematicians are wrong all the time, constantly. We say stuff that's like catastrophically wrong in front of each other. And we just deal with it because we know that saying things that are wrong is part of thinking. You know, I have a colleague at Wisconsin, Erica Halverson, who teaches like acting and theater and art and all kinds of things. And she's very big on this because in art, everybody, or especially in theater, if you're not willing to screw up, if you're not willing to just go for a joke and have it totally fall flat, like how can you act, right? You can't. But everybody knows that. Everybody understands that sort of nobody in the classroom is going to be like, well, that guy sucks if you fall flat on one joke, right? But I think in the math classroom, there is this sensation. There is this vibe that if you say something wrong, oh man, like you're a loser, like you don't belong here. That's not a math issue. That's a social issue. And I think it's one that as teachers, we can strive to have our classrooms not be like that. Now, I do that by just being a very sloppy lecturer and mess up on the board all the time because I didn't prepare enough. And then I'm like, well, you see, I'm making a pedagogical point here about how even the person with a PhD can mess up. That's my excuse for not having prepared the calculation enough.
But you're so right. It does show the way that, you know, math and really just most of the STEM fields move forward is that you try, dead ends, you know, screw up. Okay, that's not actually how you get from point A to point B. So let's try a new path. And when you quote unquote show your work out loud, it actually helps other students because they're like, that's where I'm getting stuck too. But when we don't, you know, create an environment, which you're right, it's a larger social issue, especially here in the West. But when we don't create an environment that allows for that thinking out loud, and it's okay if you don't quite get it, you're right. I think that the word you mentioned, did you say shame?
I said humiliation, but shame works.
Humiliation.
Too.
Yeah. Like it's a really not good feeling. And it doesn't help, I think, that it's socially acceptable for people to be like, math is hard. I'm bad at math. Math's not fun. And so you actually see this reinforced in television shows and films where the kid has to do their math homework and the parents like, I don't know how to help you with that. And that's like hilarious or something. And you're like, God, that's sad. That's not how it should be.
Although other things you said, you hit kind of one of my buttons because you said people are always saying math is hard. I'm bad at math. Like this isn't fun. Math is hard is great. It is hard. Okay. So I approve of that. Like, we shouldn't tell students it's easy because it's not easy. And then if we tell them it's easy and then they find it hard, what are they going to feel like? Oh, the problem's me.
Right. I'm stupid. That's true.
You guys said it was easy right there in front of the class and I can't do it. So I think we should say math is hard, but then we should get away from this I'm bad at a thing. You know what I mean? It's hard. It's hard for everybody.
Sure. Yeah. Maybe I should append that or amend that by saying math is too hard. It's insurmountably hard. It's so hard that I'll never be able to understand it. Because I do think that's what a lot of kids go into these classes thinking. I know I did.
And I think there's something, but that said, I think that a lot of mathematicians get into a kind of a defensive crouch and feel that people hate math. And I don't think that's true. As somebody now that it's part of my profession to sort of go around giving talks about math and talk to people, I think people basically like math. People accord it a lot of prestige. And if people feel like they don't understand it, I don't think people are so okay with it. They may say they're okay with it as a defense mechanism, but I think there's a hunger for it. And that's why like there's like lots of appetite for people to talk about this stuff in public.
Yeah, I think you're right. And it's obviously fundamental to pretty much anything and everything within the human realm of experience. And you, I think, do such a great job of telling these stories and making sure that you're hitting on all of these kind of seemingly disparate areas of inquiry, areas of focus, but really telling that narrative of the human experience. Like, you know, obviously you talk about really, really sort of timely things like COVID and how scientists are using modeling with COVID. But then you talk about, you know, things that are fundamental to social justice issues, things that are fundamental to human philosophy, and things that are kind of like paving the way for future technologies. What made you sort of, I guess, land? You must have had it just a laundry list of ideas of what you wanted to focus on. What made you land on the topics that you did?
Well, honestly, I can't necessarily say that my writing method is the best because it may not be. Here's what I do. I write an outline and I submit it to the press. You know, I make a pitch and I'm like, here's what the book is going to be. Here's what the chapters are going to be. And I send it in and they're like, great, write this book. Like, yeah, the contract. Then I start writing. And then each thing, as I research it, I find out about all kinds of other stuff. I'm like, oh, this thing connects to this other thing. This thing's connect, and then it connects to this third thing. I got to follow this wire and see where it goes. Keep on pulling on it to see where it leads. And so then, of course, what I actually end up writing, I'm kind of discovering it as I go. And a lot of the things I told the press I was going to write about, then I didn't write about. I kind of ran out of space. I ran out of time. But, you know, to me, what's most interesting, what gives a book or a talk or a story energy is that feeling of excitement and that feeling of discovery. So I find I'm more excited to write about stuff as I learn it. And you know, hopefully that comes through on the page. I feel like that's much more fun than writing about stuff I already know about. So I intend to write about stuff I already know about, but then I never come through.
And so tell me, is that sort of the verbal explanation of the visual map, like the mind map that's in the opening pages of your book, where it's just all these different topics and boxes and then like squiggly lines connecting some of them to others? I mean, it's a little bit Beautiful Mind, I have to admit.
Yeah, I actually did not know that kind of thing was called a mind map. I did not know it had a name. I learned that because like several people have been like, oh, you're a mind map at the beginning of the,
that's book. Funny. But there's like a convergence there. Yeah.
But yes, that's my way. That was my way of, because it is my representation of what's going on as I try to hold in my brain all the different stuff that's in the book. And more than just that, the connections between them, that web of connections that just kind of keeps on getting deeper and deeper as you go and makes what might seem like a bunch of disparate topics all connect together. My sort of vision of what that thing is. So for those who, since we're doing this on audio, as Kara said, in the beginning of the book, in the frontispiece, there's just a collection of topics, people, ideas drawn in little boxes, but then like all these kind of wiggly lines connecting all the ones that are connected through one thing or another. And it's supposed to be like, did you read like Lord of the Rings when you were a kid, or Sword of Shannara, or like any of these sort of big fat fantasy novel?
Not for fun, but I definitely was required to read some of the fantasy stuff in school. I'm definitely, you're sort of asking the wrong person about fantasy because it doesn't go well with the Talk Nerdy theme. I know it's definitely a point of contention with a lot of my friends and some of my co-hosts on the other show. But I think I know what you're saying. It's sort of like Tolkien doing what?
Well, in those books, there's always a map at the beginning. In the frontispiece of the book, there's always a map. And it's like, okay, the goblins live over here. And then the talking trees live over there. And the orcs live over in this place. And that's sort of that was sort of the vibe I wanted.
I love that. So it's like Phantom Tollbooth. That would be my example of the map at the beginning of the book. Yeah, where Milo's journey and
a formative book for all of us.
Absolutely.
R.I.P. Norton Juster.
I know. Well, I love that because as I'm looking at this map, it is, you know, like you mentioned, there are names that, you know, stick out to me and that are meaningful that I think sort of most people have in their memory, Euclid and over here we see Fibonacci and these different people who we know about. There's a lot of names I don't recognize, but of course that's the point is learning about these people because maybe they're not familiar to me. Then there are things that feel like mathematical concepts to me. I see triangles and proofs and eigenvalues and, you know, these different math terms. But then I see things that maybe I wouldn't realize would make their way in, like trees and poetry and God, democracy. And so all of these things, you know, at these multiple layers and levels, all the way from the sort of very familiar to what we might think is not as closely connected. They all weave together for you in this story.
Yeah, absolutely. And some of those were things I knew I was going to write about, and some of those things were things that developed as I wrote, like the things that sort of places I found that I had to go as I was learning and writing and developing the ideas.
You know, I'm sure a lot of people have asked you during the press about this book to talk a little bit about COVID and your experience or your research into some epidemiological aspects of COVID. When in the process of you writing this book, what did the pandemic become obviously incredibly salient? Was it there the whole time and on your mind, or did it like happen in the middle of your writing?
It happened in the middle, and to be honest, it happened at a time when I had kind of like ground to a crawl and was kind of stuck. And, you know, like there was certainly no intention of writing about the spread of pandemics as part of what I wanted to write about. But, you know, like so many other people in the world, you know, what else could you think about, right, in February, March, April of 2020? Like, so of course, you know, I was thinking about it just as a person in the world, not as a writer, but, you know, an event of such overwhelming global size and reach, everybody brings their own tools to it, right? The poets wrote poetry about it. The doctors like thought about treatment, and the mathematicians thought about the math of it. Like everybody, whatever they have to bear, they bring to it. So I found myself constantly thinking about the mathematical underpinnings of how to think about what was going on. And the more I thought about it, the more I felt that it just fit incredibly neatly into what I was already writing about. So I wrote a lot, you know, and I wrote it as things were going on, but just kind of, you know, usually most of the stuff I write about in a book like this is like stuff that was all settled and figured out like 200 years ago. Maybe
right.
This book, right? So this was a pretty interesting and novel experience to me to be like writing about stuff that was happening under my feet. But of course, me being me, I sort of wanted to go back into the history and ended up learning like a hell of a lot about how people thought about epidemics in, you know, the 1850s at a time when, by the way, this is like amazing to me, when people were thinking mathematically about the spread of disease before they even knew how disease spread. I mean, they were making these models, and then in the footnote, they'd be like, you know, some people think there's like a tiny organism that jumps from person to person that causes the disease. I don't know about that. Nobody ever saw a thing like this. I got to put it in the footnote that people say that.
Yeah, it all seems like we're having a hard time tracking this. Yeah, we can't track this miasma very well. It's very strange.
Yes, it was the miasma people. The miasma people actually were pretty decent modelers, despite having no idea how disease spread.
I love that. Oh, that's amazing. And of course, now the modeling that we utilize is incredibly sophisticated. Of course, it's only as good as the data we put in, right? So you see in some countries these amazing track and trace programs where they know, like, to the person, you know, where they picked it up, where they spread it, exactly how they're being quarantined. We're not doing that here in the United States. But that doesn't mean that there aren't some, like, incredibly sophisticated models going on to help us understand. Actually, it helps us understand the nature of the disease itself.
Yeah, exactly. And that's one of the things that is so geometric about it, because the way disease spreads is through networks of people, and a network of people has its own geometry. You know, if you look at, you can look at the progress of something like the Black Death in the Middle Ages, and the geometry of that epidemic is the same thing as the geometry of the map of Europe. You just see it kind of crawling a few miles every day, like, you know, from, let's see, from east to west. I think it was actually from more like from south to north, but in the direction it's going. And the geometry of that epidemic is the geometry of the globe. The geometry of COVID is totally different, right? Because now we live in a global interconnected network, and people get on airplanes and go from one place to another. And so it's a much richer geometry. Unfortunately, it's a much smaller geometry. It's way easier for a virus to, like, traverse it and explore it, because it's much, I mean, it's in some weird way, the whole world now is much smaller than Europe was in 1300.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's so true. And you're right. It's interesting that you see this in literature. I remember reading The Plague, right, by Camus when our plague hit. I was like, oh, some light reading here. And you see this theme over and over about, like, closing the city gates and, like, it's, you know, it's coming. It might reach us. Like, you see this a lot in literature, as if it's a wave, as if it is just moving through the air. But really, it's the spread of people, and people just didn't spread the same way. And that's why you can pinpoint pandemics, historical pandemics, in a much kind of more, I guess, crude fashion, or you can use cruder tools and still pinpoint it pretty well, as opposed to now with tracking and tracing, it's pretty much the only way, because, like, you never know where anybody is at any given time.
Right. And there's reasons, right? There's reasons why people don't want, you know, an authority to know where everybody is at any given time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right. And I think that speaks to, obviously, some of the other interesting components to the way that you've been writing about shape, the way that you're writing about geometry. But before we get into, like, some of the other kind of areas that you've focused on, and I guess this is actually directly connected. I'm working with my own mind map here. I just didn't write it down, so bear with me.
You can include a PDF of your mind map with this,
yes,
the audio.
Once file. I make it. Yeah. But there's this, there is a social justice component to this writing here. And I think, you know, we talk about COVID, for example. We talk about the importance of, understanding epidemiology. You talk a bit about gerrymandering and kind of social political issues. But there's also something a little bit deeper, which is more fundamental to math itself. And that is that learning about math is in many ways synonymous with learning about logic and learning about critical thinking and learning how to be a discerning individual. And a lot of these things are fundamentally important in a world where we're seeing a lack of skepticism in our political leaders and in our in many people who have a lot of media power, and where it's becoming harder and harder for people who don't have those tools to discern fact from fiction, because there's agenda. A lot of people have an agenda to convince individuals that fiction is fact. This has always been the case, but it's ratcheted up. It's exacerbated by the tools that are available to us. And so really learning math is also learning how to critically interact with the world, isn't it?
It is, and it's a tool. I mean, I would love to sit here and tell you that knowing a lot of math is like an mRNA level inoculation against
right.
things, but I know too many crazy mathematicians to really believe that. I'm going to be straight with you. So it's not.
Yeah, there really is no complete antidote, is there?
It's not perfect, but absolutely it gives you tools. But at the same time, gosh, once again, you gave me like five directions I could go from there.
go down all of them. We got time.
I mean, one of them, and this absolutely comes up in what I write in the book about COVID modeling, because of course, one of the main things that people know about COVID modeling is it didn't actually do that good of a job of telling the future, right? If what you wanted from it was, I just want to know what's going to happen. Science, tell me. Math, tell me. Well, that's not how it works. And I think that it's kind of a humbling lesson. You got to remember that to the outsider, a mathematician often is seen as somebody who is there to give you the answer. Right. And often the answer has huge error bars around it. And sometimes the answer is like, we just really don't know. I think, you know, for COVID, I think it's like, there's something intermediate about it. It's not a we have no idea, and it's not here's the crystal ball and I'm going to tell you what things are going to look like 6 months in the future. It's an incredibly interesting interplay between phenomena that can be well modeled and phenomena that just depend on human behavior in the aggregate, which is really hard to model. So, you know, pandemic spread is not math, it's math plus human response to math. And that's hard to model it, but that doesn't mean that the math is useless. It just means that it's limited. It just means you have to be sort of realistic about how much you're going to learn for it. But to your larger point, because I think you wanted to sort of branch out from COVID and talk about a larger point. Okay, I just read an amazing line. And who was it from? It was from Anna Kiesenhofer. I hope I've remembered her name correctly. Do you know who that is? Have you already been acquainted with the legend of Anna Kiesenhofer?
I do not, no.
Okay, so she's an Austrian mathematician working in Switzerland who just won the gold medal yesterday in the cycling road race in the Olympics.
Oh my gosh, I literally just saw a headline, yeah, that said like this mathematician is now, you know, is an Olympian. But I didn't, I like saved it in my pocket. I haven't read it yet. How cool is that? How is she so talented?
It's incredibly cool. And she just, you know, she was not considered a contender and she jumped out to a huge lead in the beginning, which you're not supposed to do because, you know, you get tired out and the people can catch you. But she jumped out to such a big lead that like nobody knew she was there. And because she was not a contender, the other, you know, the people in the peloton, the people in the pack literally mm-hmm. didn't even think to look for her and notice that she wasn't there with everybody else. And the woman who came in second thought she won. She rode across and she was like, I did it. I won. And they were like, yeah, mathematician finished like 5 minutes ago. Incredible.
Incredible.
But I didn't bring her up to talk about cycling. Interesting that that is. I read an interview with her where she said something really amazing. So just talking about her routine, she doesn't really have a coach. She coaches herself. And she said something which struck me as truly mathematical, which was everybody's going to sort of tell you that they know, and it takes a long time to realize that people don't know. I don't have the quote in front of me, so I'm paraphrasing. Sorry if I get it not quite right. She said, you have to learn that people who say they know, really nobody actually knows. And what's more, the people who do know say they don't know.
You're so right.
And, you know, this thing that you talk about, this kind of, you know, social disease of skepticism that we're living through, I think it has to do with the fact that people have captured, I mean, this is a very, very wise and very mathematical thing that she said. And I think people have grasped the first part of it, the part where, hey, just because sort of somebody in a position of authority says something doesn't mean it's true. Like maybe the people who officially know, like don't know as much as they think, but then they don't listen to the second part, which is that the people who actually know something are very honest about their uncertainty and are very direct about the fact that they don't know the future. They don't know what's going to happen. There's a lot they don't know. Instead, I think people have this appropriate attitude of skepticism towards knowledge that comes from on high, from an authority, but then they just jump to somebody else who says they know. Well, that's no good.
Oftentimes the people that they jump to, at least we're seeing with, as I don't want to make broad generalizations, but we're definitely seeing this with COVID, is that then the quote expert that they listen to has no expertise. Is somebody who join my conspiracy club. It's like, oh, Fauci, I don't believe Fauci. So instead I'm going to listen to, you know, a talk radio host.
So if you make that move, you're not really a skeptic, right? You just have decided to like have a different authority than other people who you wish to distinguish yourself from socially. Like, no, I think what Kiesenhofer says is absolutely right, that if you, as a heuristic for figuring out who knows what the hell they're talking about, like, listen to the people who sound not sure and who talk about their uncertainty and are unwilling to make definitive pronouncements, because they are probably the ones who are telling you what's closest to the truth.
I think you're right. And I think that, I mean, I know you're right, but I think that also, I know you're right with an error bars, that also speaks to a fundamental kind of American perspective, which I hope is not incompatible with that view, but it's definitely fights that view quite a lot, which is, you know, the scientific perspective and the mathematic perspective is, okay, we're observing, we're now interrogating, we've set up some hypotheses, some models, we're testing them, we're iterating them. It's not quite right here. Oh, shoot, we made a mistake, but that's okay, because now we're going to try something different. Bear with us. This is kind of how we think we know things are, but let's keep up with the most, you know, common data. And the political, sociopolitical, very American manifest destiny view is, I'm going to put down my flag. I might have picked the wrong spot. It doesn't matter. I'm going to double down. I can't afford to be wrong. If I say that I made a mistake, then all of a sudden I'm a flip-flopper. You know, I'm going to go to my grave, you know, never admitting defeat. And I think that that view is not a healthy view, first of all, for society. And unfortunately, it's in direct conflict with evidence-based policy.
Okay, so let me push back on you a bit, because I think the person in the book who is the tribune for the point of view that I think you endorse is Abraham Lincoln, the most American dude in all of history. So I don't, you know, I'm going to sort of push back on your idea.
I don't know if we would consider, I don't know if a lot of like manifest destiny kind of patriotic Americans would identify Abraham Lincoln as being, I think you're right. He's a founding father for sure. But our founding fathers were pretty intellectual, most of them. Most people have a caricatured view of what they actually thought and wrote. I think that you're right. They were probably much more nuanced and much more mind-changing than people give them credit for.
Well, let me put it this way. I don't consider myself somebody as super knowledgeable about Lincoln, even though there's a giant bronze statue of him directly outside my workplace, as there is a lot of Midwestern public universities. But I mean, reading about him for this book, he just comes off as such a winning character. And, you know, he is a lover of geometry. He tells this story of, you know, being a young lawyer and finding this is way before he's president. He's just like a sort of lawyer going around Illinois. And he has kind of a crisis of faith that he says, I'm being called into court every day, asked to prove things. And I don't even know what that word means. I asked everybody around me, what does that mean? What do you mean when you say you prove something? Nobody can answer me. So he says, that's when I went to Euclid, and I'm like, I can't be a lawyer until I've like read Euclid and know what it actually means to prove something. And this was very much his personality. Not an austere, abstract person, but somebody who had, and this I do honestly think, Kara, is like a pretty American outlook too, in contradistinction to what you called an American outlook. This idea, like you shouldn't say something unless you can back it up. The kind of skepticism that comes with not just reflexive, I don't believe you because I don't like you, but the kind of honest skepticism that comes with saying, let me understand what assumptions go into what you say. Let me understand what it comes from. Let me understand if I can construct an argument for that myself. And if I can, and if it seems airtight to me, then I believe it. And that's very much not just what Lincoln said he was doing, but what the people around Lincoln described him as doing. Now, whether he got that from learning geometry or whether he was just like that and so he sort of found something that resonated with his soul reading geometry, that we can't know, right?
And so talk to me a little bit about this concept of proof, because this is intriguing to me. You know, I think one of the things that's fundamentally frustrating about my field, which, you know, was neurobiology, now is clinical psychology and much more philosophically grounded, like existential clinical psychology, is that you can't prove anything. You can sort of disprove, you can reject hypotheses, you can sort of say we have pretty good evidence to support this. And so it seems to be the prevailing model of the time. But with geometry, there are proofs. And so like, how does that translate into what Lincoln was saying, like going into the courtroom and proving something?
Yeah, well, that's where I got to pull the football away a little bit, right? Because it's not like you're going out into the world and you're like, somebody's like, you're in big trouble unless you can explain to me why, how you know the sum of the angles of a triangle is 180 degrees, right? That doesn't happen. Right? It would be great. It would be great. But that doesn't happen. So, you know, the way I say it in the book is that I'd love to tell you that we learn geometry because the world is full of proofs. It's not. But the world is full of non-proofs. Non-proofs that are dressed up as proofs. Non-proofs that announce themselves in public as proofs. And once you really know proofs, you know the difference. And that's very, very useful.
Yeah, interesting. Right. So it's like really kind of understanding the sort of the template. I don't want to say the perfect template, but the ideal template. I'm not really sure if I'm communicating this appropriately, but like knowing a sort of ideal template allows you then to go, okay, this is pretty far away from that, or this is relatively close to that.
Yeah, like my I always say, if you ever hear anybody say therefore, and they're not doing geometry, that's when you know to be skeptical. Or if you hear somebody, people do this a lot, if they say, well, logically, you must believe then that, and you should just be like, must I? That's a tell. They're telling you, hey, here's the weak point. I wouldn't be sort of puffing up my chest and using this proof language unless this was the exact point of weakness in my argument.
What did the philosophy professors at your university say to that? The ones who teach logic.
Well, I think the philosophy professors who teach logic teach a very formal logic of the same kind that we do. I'm chill with the philosophy.
I think you're so right. There's like massive parallels between formal logic and, yeah, geometric proofs. And it's really cool that they really do serve as these sort of, I don't know, I keep going back to the word ideal, which I don't think is quite what I'm trying to say, but these sort of like parsimonious templates for conditions in which all the variables are understood, controlled, blah, 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 that they actually can be informative for us in a messier world that's full of confabulating variables.
Yeah. And, you know, as a psychologist, you know very well that the mechanism by which human beings form beliefs is not purely formal, never will be, never can be.
No. But that's you're right.
But that's part of geometry too. You know, one of the major figures in the book is Henri Poincaré, who was this kind of great geometer of the turn of the century. And gosh, I've sort of had to develop the habit as I get older of saying, I mean the term between the 19th and the 20th century. Now there's been another one already. But
you're right.
And, you know, Poincaré was very insistent that geometry was not just a process of formal deduction. That's the way we teach it sometimes. But that I think what he saw in it was exactly this interplay between formal proof and our intuition that comes from our body and comes from our experience. I mean, that's what makes geometry geometry, right? That it's related to the things we actually experience in our bodies moving through space. And he was very insistent, and I'm totally on board with Poincaré here, that the subject can't stand on just either one of those. It needs both. You need to be connected both with your intuitive faculty and your rigorous deductive reasoning faculty at the same time, or your host. He didn't use the word host, but
he is the host of the era, which I'm unsure what that would have been. Yeah, you know, it's interesting to me, like as a public communicator of mathematics, and also somebody who is, you know, who's doing academic math, who's then teaching academic math, but probably some more kind of adaptive or modern, kind of more interesting. I don't want to say interesting, but more, what's the word I'm looking for? You know, math for like a modern student who's like, come on, let's do something more than just these formal proofs, as you said. And also then this like broader public communication of mathematics for individuals with varied academic backgrounds and varied interests. Do you find that there are certain stories or certain constructs, certain areas where, for example, with shape, specifically, because this is not your first book and not your first type of math that you've done a lot of public communication about, but maybe we'll stick with geometry for the purposes of this question. Do you find that there are areas of application that speak more or less to people, or is it as varied as, you know, individuals' unique experiences?
It's pretty varied. I definitely find that when people talk to me about, you know, if I hear from readers, it's like all over the map what part they specifically responded to. And in some sense, you know, it's something that I've learned as a teacher over the last 20 years that I used to think, let me figure out the right way to do this.
Right.
And I've learned over the years, boy, there's no one right way. Something that one student loves, another student will hate. And my best option is to kind of mix it up and do different things so that everybody will have that moment when they're like, oh, now I get what he's saying. I don't know what that other garbage was that was happening for the last 20 minutes. But as long as everybody has some of that. So I'll say
so it's
this,
about
though.
Breadth, I mean, for you. Like, it's
but
really,
I will
like,
say that
really
one thing
important.
People respond to, which is not exactly a topic of geometry or of the book, but you know, I think people want to talk about teaching and want to talk about education, partly just because that is a very universal experience, at least in this country, that like people have been in a math class and they have feelings about it, man. They have feelings about it.
Yeah, they do. What and did you wait? I have to interject really quick, Jordan. I love that you wrote how math is like cilantro. or is it geometry is like cilantro?
It's the cilantro of math.
Yeah, the cilantro of math. Yeah, you love it, hate it. But very few people are neutral. I do love math, but I hate cilantro, just putting that out there. Anyway, go on.
But yeah, that's something. It definitely has a certain charge. And, you know, of course, I'm biased, but I think that's because mathematics itself has a certain charge. I think it's, you know, there's a reason it's present in like every human society that has ever existed. It's a basic part of our cognitive apparatus. And so I think it's actually maybe one of the things I'm trying to do by writing these books is emphasize this point that it's not a walled off thing that the second you walk out of 12th grade, you're like, well, I'm done with that. Like, that's a part of my childhood, like listening to boy bands. Like, no, it's, you know, it's there with you always.
Yeah, it's fundamental to everything. And you're right. We even see it in human development, that some of the earliest things that we notice about the, like a baby and then an infant and then, or a baby is an infant and then a toddler's experience is, you know, learning language and then learning like the ability to see through a quantified lens, the ability to count, the ability to compare, or the ability to, understand what happens when you remove, you know, when we talk about like basic kind of developmental psychology, we talk about, you know, understanding that the same amount of liquid is in this vase of this shape versus that vase of that shape. And these are like developmental benchmarks. It's so fundamental. It's definitely not just an academic enterprise.
And I think, you know, this last year that we've gone to, it has been a quantitative mathematical time. I think people, maybe it's come closer to the surface than it is for most people most of the time, thinking about living through this pandemic. People are thinking about uncertainty. People are thinking about spread. People are thinking about numbers. People are thinking about curves in a way that is, you know, closer to the top of their consciousness than it usually is.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. So I can imagine that simply because of the cross-section of time that we're in, kind of going back to that question I asked you, that a lot of people are probably fundamentally interested in these conversations about COVID and epidemiology. You know, when I think about like all these different topics, it's weird because my background is biology. And although I'm really fascinated by and think there's so much beauty in sort of the elegance of shapes within nature, you know, the geometry of nature is interesting to me. I find myself much more drawn lately to these conversations about democracy, about social justice, about, you know, these different topics that relate to equity and kind of the human experience. So I'm wondering from you personally, you know, it's unique, you know, everybody has their unique interest areas. What was the most interesting to you when you were writing about all these different topics?
Well, before I answer that, can I just say, because once again, you gave me something interesting to just, I mean, if we're going to talk about math and equity and social justice, let's take a moment to remember that Bob Moses died yesterday or the day before, who is a major, major civil rights leader. But what he was thinking about the last 20 years of his life was, you know, he launched a thing called the Algebra Project.
Yeah.
And he recognized that equity in math education was a civil rights issue and a crucial one. And that was what he chose to do. And he did incredible things, kind of really getting that equity perspective and saying math education is not for a few, like math education is for everybody. It's a basic human need. So
Yeah, and he saw. You're right. And he saw that it shouldn't be a privilege. It should be a right, because it actually leads downstream to important outcomes. That having that equality in math education can and often does mean improved outcomes in your life, better jobs, better income potential, better social standing. And because of that, that was fundamental. You're right. You're absolutely right. So it's really operating on two levels here. Math education is a social justice imperative. And on top of that, understanding math helps us understand things like gerrymandering, like redlining, like lack of parity in healthcare, and a lot of the things that ultimately we need the mathematic prowess to be able to tackle from a social justice perspective.
But that leads me, I will answer your question now, because you actually led me right there, and it's great.
Oh, good.
I think you can always tell what I, in my heart, care about the most, because I put it at the end of the book. You know, like you put your best song at the end of the musical, so people like walk out humming it.
Oh, yeah.
Same deal. That's how books work, too. And so the stuff that's at the end of the book, you know, there's this poem by Rita Dove called Geometry. The book is full of poems, by the way. I had no idea that there were sort of so many geometers who wanted to be poets, or poets who wanted to be mathematicians or whatnot. But Rita Dove, the former poet laureate of the United States, wrote a poem called Geometry that starts, this is also the title of the last chapter, "I prove a theorem and the house expands." It's this story of kind of this incredible epiphanic experience she has, like as a school child, learning about geometry and understanding the proof of the theorem. And it speaks to something, and that's what the last chapter of the book is about, that geometry can be a liberatory activity. I think it is so often thought of as like a formal cage for your mind that you have to live through. And in fact, many people throughout history, not just Rita Dove, have seen it in quite the opposite way, that what makes geometry special, what makes it different from everything else in the schoolroom, is that it is the place where you can make your own knowledge. You're not reliant on an authority, right? I mean, you're not reliant on the history class. You got to believe what the book tells you, right? I mean, it's about stuff that happened 100 years ago. In geometry, you are the authority, your own reasoning faculty. And so many people throughout history, and so many children right now as we speak, okay, not now because it's July, but when everybody rolls back into the schoolroom, are having that experience of, I made this knowledge myself and it's right. Not because the teacher told me, but because it's true. And writing about Rita Dove and writing about the story of Flatland, which is another story of geometric epiphany, and this amazing Talmudic story of the oven of Achnai, where the reasoning rabbis defeat God. Great story. I'm not even going to tell the whole story, but let's just say that they get an argument with God, the rabbis win, and God just starts uncontrollably laughing and is like, my children have defeated me. My children have defeated me. He's absolutely delighted. That's God being a math teacher, right? That's God being like, this is what I gave you, you people, you human beings. I gave you the ability to do exactly this so that you would do what you just did. And it's delightful and hilarious and it's awesome.
Yeah. I love that. Yeah. I mean, you're so right. There's something, I don't know, that's fundamentally empowering about an individual coming to an epiphany, coming to a realization, not because, you know, believe it because I told you to, you know, like, why does this happen? Because I say so. Like, not because of that, but because the building blocks are in front, I can put them together in these multiple ways. And now I've created something with that I can take 100% ownership over. Like, there's almost nothing more empowering in the world than being able to be the author of a mental creation.
Exactly. And, you know, as teachers, it can be both. We can use it to bludgeon or we can use it to liberate, and we got to decide. Mm.
Oh, I love that. Well, honestly, Jordan, I think that might be a perfect place. Like as kind of succinct and pithy as that is, what an important place for us to kind of to wrap things up, to close things up. I mean, before we do, I always ask the same, I always ask my guests the same two questions. So hopefully we have time to go over those for just a couple of minutes. But before we do, is there anything, I mean, there's so many things, but is there anything that you feel like, oh, why didn't we get there? We really should have mentioned that.
No, this was great. You know, what I love about doing these talks is it's different every time because that's what's good about writing. Like every reader is different. You think you know what's in your book and then every reader reflected off that reader. It's like a different thing. So you learn something every time.
You're speaking my language, that intersubjectivity. You are so right. So Jordan, I'm really interested because, I mean, especially I haven't done a math story maybe since John Urschel was on the show. He might have been the last.
Love that guy. I will say I wrote a profile of him, which is probably, I don't want to like pat my own back, but it's like my favorite magazine piece I ever wrote.
No way. I wonder if I linked to it in the show.
It's one of the top two.
Amazing.
I had such a good time talking to him. I really went deep on it. It was,
that makes me so happy.
It's called John Urschel Goes Pro.
Yay. Okay. Very cool. Yeah. I had Urschel on the show, Ben Orland. I'm trying to see some of the different kind of math people I've talked to. Definitely Steve Strogatz. I've talked to
literally all three of those people make appearances in Shape, by the way. Orland.
I love that.
Urschel and Strogatz.
Such a small world. I love it so much. So, regardless, it's been a while and I'm definitely interested, especially because of your unique perspective about these two big picture questions. I close every episode with them. I have no idea if one day I'll compile something with the answers, but here they go. So when you think about the future, in whatever context is relevant to you, so it could be informed by your work, it could be very personal to you, it could be, you know, very small, familial, community level, or huge, we're talking global, cosmic level, whatever context is relevant to you or salient. Number one, what is the thing that keeps you up the most at night, the thing that you're most concerned about, maybe pessimistic, maybe even cynical about? But then on the flip side, to end it on, you know, a slightly more positive note, what are you looking forward to? Where do you find your optimism? You know, what are you hopeful for?
Let me just say this. Math is an inexhaustible, it's a renewable resource. It's inexhaustible. There will never not be new ideas to learn and they will never not bring pleasure. That I do think is true. And that's maybe a small thing. It's not cosmic.
I don't know. That seems pretty big to me. There's something very existential about what you're saying, that there's just this, it's like an untapped, not, it's not untapped, but it's a never-ending resource. Like it's a renewable resource. It will always be. It will always continue to be. And it's very likely that we will never know everything there is to know.
Yeah. And maybe that's a good way to put it, that I think something that mathematicians know about math that maybe the general public doesn't know about math is that what we don't know is so cosmically vastly bigger than what we do know that we're not in any danger of figuring it all out. There's no peak math, right? That doesn't exist.
And isn't it funny that for some, that realization is a little bit groundless. It's a little unbounded and it's frightening. Oh my gosh, we only know a fraction of what there is to know. Oh no, we're so behind. Oh no, there's so much to do. And yet for others, it opens up the potential for, you know, multiple lifetimes of curiosity. And what a beautiful thing that there will always be more to discover.
Absolutely.
Well, Jordan, thank you so much for spending the time with us today. Everybody, the book is Shape, The Hidden Geometry of Information, Biology, Strategy, Democracy, and Everything Else by Dr. Jordan Ellenberg. I had a blast and I learned an awful lot.
Me too. And it's my book.
And everyone listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.